From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Marines will court-martial a drill instructor in the death of a Muslim recruit from Taylor.
Rahil died on American soil in boot camp. This wasn't on the battlefield. This was at home. And that's what's most concerning here.
The most difficult thing is, no matter what we do, we can never bring this young son back to his mother.
An exhibition in Hamtramck connects atrocities committed against Polish children in World War II and against children today in the Middle East.
If we can feel sad for what happened to children in Poland, we can equally feel sad about what is happening to children in the Middle East.
Taking an idea born in Dublin, planting it here in Michigan, the Science Gallery Lab, where science and art collide.
It's kind of like a performative moving theater exhibit.
Those stories and more. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The meter continues to run on the state's and our governor's legal expenses for the Flint water disaster. Michigan taxpayers have so far been billed about $12 million. Detroit Free Press reporter Paul Egan is here to talk about these legal bills with us via Skype. Paul, what did Michigan taxpayers get for their $12
million? Well, that's a good question, Cynthia, because these cases haven't been resolved yet, most of them, either the civil cases or the criminal cases. So it's really very difficult to say at this point what we are getting. State employees are getting excellent criminal lawyers to work on their behalf, those that have been charged by the Attorney General, Bill Schuette, and even some who have not been charged but are only under criminal investigation have also got criminal defense help.
And how much of this is going to lawyers hired by Governor Rick Snyder, the civil and criminal?
Roughly a third of it. Over $3 million is going to attorneys hired by Governor Rick Snyder, and he spent $2.5 million on a criminal defense contract and the balance of it on a civil defense contract. And that's been somewhat controversial, Cynthia, because certainly there haven't been any charges brought against the governor. What his office has said is that a large amount of the money spent on the criminal defense contract is going to produce documents. They've received subpoenas from both the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Schuette investigation. And they say that a large part of the money is really going to, you know, people to go through and produce documents that are needed for various investigations that are going on.
Now, your piece in the Free Press, Paul Egan, points out that this $12 million we're talking about does not include money that the state departments, the DEQ and the Health and Human Services Department, have paid to the Attorney General's office for all the civil lawsuits?
Right. I wanted to take a look at what's being spent on outside attorneys. Now, they have hired some outside attorneys for some of the civil lawsuits, and that money is included. But because the other money is really moving from one state pocket into another state pocket, I didn't include that. But it is over, well over $500,000. We were able to get numbers from some of the departments, but not others. But basically, when the Attorney General does work for a state department, that state department is still expected to send money over to the Attorney General's office to pay for that. You know, the numbers we had from a couple of departments were several hundred thousand, and I think it was the Department of Health we couldn't get numbers for, which would certainly put that over $500,000.
Bouncing back to these outside attorneys, there's some pretty big names that are being brought into this. Give us some idea.
You know, I used to cover federal court in Detroit, covered a number of the big trials there, and attorneys such as Steve Fishman, probably one of your best known attorneys in Michigan. He's representing one of the former emergency managers. You also have Mark Krieger, Harold Gurowitz, Robert Morrison, a number of very highly regarded and generally highly compensated attorneys are involved in representing some of these defendants that the Attorney General has charged.
To that point, I know you spoke with an outside expert, a law professor at Western Michigan, Cooley, who knows about attorney fees. Are these fees outsized or are they what's to be expected?
Well, he certainly was not surprised at the amount that has been spent so far. You know, in some ways, I've certainly seen the hourly fees on some of the contracts. We're talking several hundred dollars per hour for a number of these attorneys, which, again, is not unusual. Professor Swartz did make an interesting suggestion, which was that we don't really know to what extent these bills are being scrutinized in detail by the state, not only the hourly rate, but, you know, how many hours are being charged and whether there are any concerns about these invoices. One of his suggestions was that the legislature might want to set up a panel, whether consisting of judges or possibly some retired judges that don't have anything to do with the Flint issue, to review these bills, because we are still at a relatively early stage in this too, Cynthia. These bills are going to continue to come in for many, many years in some cases. It may be prudent for the state just to get a good management system to have some scrutiny and control over this.
Yeah, because the clear message of your piece in the Free Press, Paul Egan, is that the taxpayers better hold on because we're not done yet.
Not by a long shot. And of course, the other numbers that aren't included here is the actual cost of the settlements in some of these lawsuits. We recently just had a big federal lawsuit settled, which is under that settlement, the state is going to be on the hook for tens of millions of dollars for water line replacement in Flint. Now, you could argue that the state was going to do that anyway, but that settlement sets a specific timeline for a number of water lines to be replaced each year. And, you know, we may see many more settlements or possible judgments against the state and or the city of Flint in the coming years.
Detroit Free Press reporter Paul Egan. As always, Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
It's a tiny company packing a big punch with investors. Electric car maker Tesla now has a higher market value than Ford and just behind number one, GM. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us now. Let's start with some numbers, Daniel. How much do investors value Tesla stock?
Well, a couple of days ago, it was about $49.5 billion compared to Ford, which is about $44 or $45 billion, which is just unbelievable considering how many cars they make and how long they've been in business. I think they were founded in 2003. Ford was founded 100 years earlier, if my memory serves, in 1903. And it's just remarkable. But it really shows that profitability today is no guarantee of growth tomorrow. And I think the street is really betting on Tesla being kind of the answer for the future, in not only cars, but in other sectors as well.
Well, yeah, let's get into this, because as you point out, there's a lot of differences. I know in 2016, I think Tesla sold fewer than 80,000 cars. Ford mm-hmm. sold more than 2.5 million. And you point out very skillfully in your column today in the news, investors don't seem to be bothered if Tesla loses money or misses production targets. The stock just keeps going up. And the same investors are certainly not as forgiving with the big car companies. So what gives?
A different set of rules. I mean, essentially you have legacy car companies, GM, Ford, Chrysler, Toyota. They all have been around for decades, if not a century or more. They've got a lot of costs baked in. They've got bureaucracies. They've got corporate cultures. They've got, I mean, all sorts of things they're managing. And Tesla's a startup and is looking at and approaching the business in an entirely different way, is betting on continually moving away from the carbon economy, which certainly is not so much happening right now. And in the United States market, you know, hybrids and electric vehicles account for less than 3% of the overall market. So the other thing that's interesting to me is competition that's coming. A lot of these mainline manufacturers are all going to be introducing electric vehicles in a more affordable segments. General Motors already has done it with the Chevrolet Bolt, which we've talked about many times. And there are a number of other manufacturers, Honda, Volkswagen, Nissan, Audi, Jaguar, who are all coming with electric vehicles, all of which, the sum total of which, are competitors for Tesla. And they've got more established distribution and dealer networks, more established manufacturing systems. So he's all of a sudden going to be going from selling just luxury cars at $90,000, $100,000 a pop that are, in essence, for a lot of people, kind of vanity plays, to playing in the volume segments of the market. So he's going to be going against the teeth of the industry. Mm. So we'll really see to what extent and how successful he can be.
Yeah, because it makes me wonder how dazzled investors are by that Silicon Valley model where they kind of find users first and figure out profits later, and also just by Elon Musk himself.
Well, you know, I was at a thing a couple weekends ago, and there was a venture capital guy there who specializes in this area, and several of us said at the table, would you short Tesla? And the guy's response is really interesting. He said, shorting Tesla is shorting Elon Musk. He said, and essentially what he was saying is the business model of Tesla may look like a loser, but Elon Musk is a master marketer, and he's a visionary. And so essentially what you're doing, if you bet against the company, you're betting against him. So in his argument and his analysis, you really can't separate the two. You know, if you look at it on paper, you think this company is just not built for the long term. And I think a lot of people who are in the traditional industry, they react that way. The analysts react that way. There are other analysts, however, who are saying, listen, you need to understand what this is about. This is not just about the auto industry, or the mobility industry, which could be as high as $10 trillion. Tesla is a play in a number of other segments like infrastructure and electronics and other things like that. And as a result, that's why they look at this and say there's so much more growth potential here.
How worried are the big three about Tesla?
Oh, I think they're worried. I think they recognize some of the things we're talking about. I think one of the single biggest issues that bedevils General Motors and Ford particularly is the fact that they're making more money in the United States than they've made in the last 50 years, and Wall Street just yawns and their valuations don't move. Meanwhile, Elon Musk will come out with something and basically say, I'm going to do something, or we're getting closer on production of our compact Model 3, and the stock bumps up over $300 a share. And they just pull their hair out, and recognizing that if they pulled some of these stunts, made promises they couldn't keep or didn't keep, they would be crucified in the street. They would be lambasted by analysts, raked over the coals. The media would do the same thing, and the stock price would take a hit. He does some of the same stuff, and the stock price keeps going up. And they're just pulling their hair out. The other thing, too, is that I do think there's a Silicon Valley patina here, and there's also a Detroit punishment factor. That Detroit is paying the price for its sins of the past, mm-hmm. which include, of course, bankruptcy. Silicon Valley has a halo with a lot of investors. A lot of investors have made a lot of money betting smartly on various products and companies in Silicon Valley. Betting, as you said earlier, that you know that if you have the right markets and you have the right product, the profitability will come. And there is a lot of cases where that has happened. And I think a lot of people think that he's going to be the next new thing. What I think is happening here, though, is that you have other players who are bringing their engineering and manufacturing expertise to bear here, and I don't think it's at all clear that he's going to be the guy who emerges as the king of this.
This global electric game, as you say, he's not the only player, and he may not be the guaranteed winner.
That's right.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Still to come, an interactive exhibition in Hamtramck connects atrocities committed against Polish children in World War II and children today in the Middle East. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we ease our way into spring, a lot of us are planning this year's garden. Erica Kempter wants to encourage you. Think about planting heirloom seeds. The result will be a chance to taste surprising and often forgotten foods that belong right here in the Great Lakes region. Erica is the co-owner of Nature and Nurture, an organic seed farm outside of Ann Arbor and a Slow Food Board member. And it's very good to have you with us on Stateside, Erica.
Thank you.
How do you define heirloom seed? How old does it have to be to qualify?
There's a lot of different definitions, but usually 50 years. And then the other definition includes kind of a cultural tradition or a place associated with those seeds.
When you grow food from these heirloom seeds, what are you getting you don't get when you just buy seeds or foods that come from elsewhere?
A lot of different things. You are getting oftentimes more flavor, which is really exciting. You know, the amount of food that's available in our grocery stores is quite limited compared to what's actually out there and available to eat.
And it's funny as you say that, because I think we like to think, oh, look at all the choice we have when we go into the supermarket, and it can come from anywhere, and we can have these things all year round. We're not limited by the seasons, but
yeah.
We're losing something.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much available that you can get if you start your own seeds, or even going to the farmer's market, more of these things are available.
So give me some examples of the kinds of heirloom fruits and vegetables that we could be growing from heirloom seeds, maybe things that have been forgotten.
One of the things I really love is a melon from Benzie County, Michigan. It's called Emerald Gem, and it is a really fabulous melon. It's sweet and juicy and fruity flavor. It's kind of a whole body experience when you eat it. The flesh is really soft, and that's why you don't find melons like that in the grocery store, because they can't be packaged and shipped. But when you eat it, it kind of melts in your mouth, and it's just incredible, delectable.
Because I will contrast that to often disappointing melons when you cut into them that you buy, and there's like not much taste.
Yes, yes, disappointing, right?
What else?
I love, there's this early Detroit tomato that we found, and I had to go to extraordinary measures to get this seed. There's been a lot of loss of heirlooms. In the last 100 years, we've lost thousands and thousands of heirlooms. And so some of our work is to preserve those heirlooms. So there's this one called Early Detroit Tomato. We got the seeds from the U.S. Department of Agriculture Seed Bank and brought that seed back to Michigan. And it's an incredible flavored tomato.
How is it different from what we all think of as a tomato?
Well, it looks similar to a standard kind of medium round red slicing tomato. But the flavor is just pop in your mouth. It has this incredible balance between sweetness and tartness and just has a strong flavor. A lot of tomatoes, you know, store-bought tomatoes are really mild and boring. And it has a perfect texture, too.
You're putting it kindly, by the way. You really, really are. What about the Pottawatomie lima bean?
The Pottawatomie lima bean, that really is an interesting bean. We got that bean from a seed saver, and it is from the Pottawatomies, who used to be the Native American peoples of this area. And some of our work is to encourage Native American people to reclaim their food traditions and histories that have been lost. And so they are working to do that. And so also by selling this bean through our seed company, we are promoting the stories of Native Americans and their history and also what they're working on now to kind of reclaim those food traditions.
Erica, why do biodiversity and heirloom seeds matter? I mean, I'm thinking of my husband's Irish forebears. He's from County Cork, Ireland. They got hammered in the Irish potato famine.
Yeah.
How does that tie in? What did that teach us?
Yeah, that's a great example. What that taught us is that we need a lot of biodiversity in our food. That's genetic biodiversity that we need. And in the Irish potato famine, what happened was there was only one type of potato that was grown throughout the entire island. And then that year, there was a blight that came through. That's a disease that knocked out all those potatoes. And because they were all genetically identical, they all died and people starved. And so it teaches us a big lesson about having a lot of food biodiversity in our food system. So that's part of our work, too, to preserve older heirlooms and then also to kind of create new heirlooms as well. And we call them heirlooms of tomorrow.
Heirlooms of tomorrow. And when you think of what we're seeing in terms of climate change, can having this diversity help us?
Yes, it can help us tremendously. And every time we grow heirlooms as a seed farmer, what we're doing is we're kind of adapting them to the climate of our region. But every year that you grow them, you're kind of selecting them. So if it's a dry year, then that year, whichever ones do the best, we always save seed from the strongest plants. So if you have a field full of tomatoes, say, you collect the tomatoes from the ones that are the most vigorous plants, the most disease-resistant plants. And so if it's a dry year, then you're also, by nature, collecting the ones that have the genetics that are better for a dry year or for a flood or for a certain disease or whatever that is. And heirlooms are incredible in that they have the ability to kind of evolve with time, and so that they should be able to evolve with climate change.
Erica Kempter, you're a pro. What about the amateur home gardener? Are these easy things to grow, these heirloom seeds?
Yeah. We actually select our seeds for being vigorous and high yielding and disease resistant, and so it is easy for home gardeners. And that's actually what a lot of home gardeners will grow heirlooms, because they want that flavor. They want that biodiversity. And you just have to make sure you're getting ones that are good. Not all seeds are created equal. So we make sure that our seeds are really high quality.
So bottom line, what do you say to home gardeners as they're thinking about what they're going to plant this spring?
Think about what you love to eat, number one, and think about how much time and space you have to devote to your garden. I know we all tend to overplan this time of year, and think about what's easiest to grow and what you love to grow. And if you have kids, get the kids out there and what they love to grow, and get them involved in food, because healthy eating leads to healthy eating as adults.
And just thinking heirloom, that idea of exploring new tastes that have been forgotten that need to be out there again. dead.
Yes, yes.
Erica Kempter is the co-owner of Nature and Nurture. It's an organic seed farm outside of Ann Arbor. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Have a good one.
The horrifying images we all saw this week of Syrian children after a apparent chemical gas attack are a very grim reminder of that famous saying, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. That observation by philosopher George Santayana is a good way to frame a remarkable exhibition happening right now in Hamtramck. The Wall Speaks, Voices of the Unheard, is now running at Bank Sui, the community space in the heart of multi-ethnic Hamtramck. It ties together stories of Polish children who lost their lives or their homes to German and Soviet invaders, and the millions of children from the Middle East suffering and displaced right now. The creator of The Wall Speaks, Voices of the Unheard, is artist and historian Wojtek Sava, who's with us now. Wojtek, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And we welcome Alyssa Shelton. She's the owner of Bank Sui and hosting this exhibition from now until Memorial Day, May 29th. Welcome, Alyssa.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Wojtek, just what is The Wall Speaks?
The Wall Speaks is a multimedia exhibition. It's composed of several different elements, of photographs, of video, of artifacts. And it speaks, as you mentioned, about the fate of Polish children in World War II. There were over 1 million people who died, hundreds of thousands of children who were forcibly deported to Siberia or to Germany, to slave camps or to be Germanized. So it tells their story. It's a story of the reason why I call it The Wall Speaks, Voices of the Unheard, is because both the enemies, the invaders, Germans and Soviets were, of course, not interested in having that narrative shared or made public. And then, unfortunately, after the war, because of political expediency, because of Roosevelt's and Churchill's alliance with Stalin, that story was misrepresented and could not be told as it was. And neither could it be told in communist Poland for many, many years.
And then take us up to the stories of the children in the Middle East today. And how did you determine that you wanted to connect them in this exhibition?
I feel that the children who are most suffering in the world right now as a result of war are our children in the Middle East. And it seemed to be natural to build this bridge because I feel that, A, children are that phenomenon that we relate to on a very emotional and primal basis. So I thought if I'm going to build bridges, this is a very good place to do it, because if we can feel sad for what happened to children in Poland, we can equally feel sad about what is happening to children in the Middle East. And at this point, national differences, religious differences, I think become, you know, they dissipate because of our emotion and how we feel towards these children.
Or we hope they would.
But I think in many cases, as this exhibition already has proven, they do. So what I'm trying to do is build a bridge, build a connection. For example, in the body of the exhibit itself, the main item are our large-scale photographs and life stories. But on the walls, where there are large windows in Bank Sui, these windows are covered with very large tarps, drop cloths, canvas, which symbolically speak of tents in refugee camps. And each of these drop cloths has a name of a refugee camp and the population in that refugee camp. So there's a very direct juxtaposition of what was and what is currently.
Alyssa, why did you open Bank Sui for this exhibition?
I think that at Bank Sui, we're always trying to host events that are making people think about nuance and making people think about things differently, understanding people more, understanding things differently. And I think that Wojtek's art is like just really an amazing way to bridge history and introduce this history that people may not know.
Explain to us what Bank Sui is.
So Bank Sui is a community space, and we host a variety of different programs. So it's purposely always changing. So people often come in and ask us, like, what is this going to be? And we're like, well, it's going to be something different every time you come in. And this is a very, I guess, tricky concept, but we think of it as a new way to fill a storefront space that hopefully maybe, you know, is a model that we can test out and other people can do. So basically we have workshops, we have talks, we have trainings, but the thread that kind of is common through all of our programming is that it's a space for exchange, it's a space for learning. And in most cases, the presenter of the program is also hopefully learning as much as the guests of the program.
So, is it a former bank?
Yeah. So the name actually is very literal. It was built in 1923 as a bank, closed during the Great Depression, but most recently was a chop suey restaurant. So from the 80s, it was Golden Hill Chop Suey.
And so in this exhibition, Wojciech, you've done interviews with World War II survivors from Poland. Tell us a little about how you present those stories.
The stories are presented in multiple ways. Photographs, they're large, you know, human-scale photographs, and they show these survivors as children. They show them as they were at the time of the war, which is pretty miraculous in itself because, as I mentioned, they had been thrown to Siberia, the concentration camps, Germany, Italy, all over the world. There are life stories next to each photograph. These are printed on fabric, and they speak to the fact that, you know, our life is we're very, very vulnerable. Our life is fleeting, especially in warlike conditions. And we need to take the life stories are printed on fabric, very delicate fabric, and we need to take them literally into our hands. So we need to take somebody's life into our hands and kind of hold it there and become acquainted with it. I think war and conditions associated with it tell us how temporal life is. We can die within, you know, less than a second. Yet the story of a life is an extremely powerful story. It's a testimony of the strength of human spirit. So it's that juxtaposition there between the delicate and the strong. There are also bricks under each photograph, and these bricks have an inscription on the top side which speak of institutional actions taken with the purpose of turning Poles into sort of a subhuman slave race, where the Germans made conscription lists and executed or sent to concentration camps Polish intellectuals. The Soviet killed 20,000 Polish officers, executed them. So I ask people, visitors, to pick up a brick and walk through the exhibit with it to feel that burden and also feel the burden of not just being put in that situation, but not being able to share your story. And I think that's very important because it's akin, you know, to a woman who's been raped, a child who's been molested, where the powers that be are so great that not only are you shamed, not only are you abused, but you cannot speak the truth about your story.
Wojciech, this exhibit's been shown in Poland. It has been shown at the Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg, in Chicago, at universities across the United States. Why Hamtramck?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question. I love Hamtramck, and Hamtramck actually mirrors, you know, the situation we're speaking of. So if we're bridging Polish past and Muslim present, that is Hamtramck. Hamtramck is a city that was predominantly Polish-American. It's predominantly Muslim right now. And those communities are somewhat cellular. They're, you know, they're traditional. They don't in any way harm each other, but sometimes there's little contact amongst them. So I thought, well, if I show this exhibit in Hamtramck, it could be a wonderful opportunity to bridge those communities together. And because it is a small community, it's only 2 square miles, it's a walkable community. You can actually see the people that you're addressing. So all these accompanying events that we have over 2 months are to a large degree directed to the Muslim world. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to make that connection and, you know, and build, essentially, I believe that art is action, ritual, and transformation. That's you know, that's what I use as an acronym for art. And I think this gives us a chance to create a space, an environment, in which those communities can come together and share.
And this seems like Bang Sui is the perfect place, Alyssa, because you are right there in the heart of Hamtramck, and you want to be a very flexible community space.
Yeah, we're very excited. I mean, I think that when we think about what we present, it's often programming. And so it's very exciting to have this exhibition for several months. But the more exciting aspect of it to me is the way the exhibition changes, you know, week to week, day to day, through both the participation of people who are seeing the exhibit and the wall sort of changing, but also through the things we're able to present each week. So we have, you know, discussions, lectures, sort of cultural exchange each week that adds to and layers on to the what's happening with the exhibition.
So there'll be a whole array of things happening, yeah, centered around the exhibition between now and May 29th. Mm-hmm.
There's one thing that Alyssa mentioned, which is very important, and she mentioned about the wall changing. So something I hadn't mentioned is that after the viewers pick up a brick, they walk up to a wall. It's a steel grid with 100 openings the size of a brick. And I ask them to flip the brick. And on the bottom side, there's a blank. And they can. And then I ask them to write of their own experiences, mm-hmm, of trauma and of not being able to share that trauma. So what is happening and what happened, for example, at the Florida Holocaust Museum is that there were hundreds of entries there from molested children, from battered women, from dyslexics, from members of the LGBTQ community, from immigrants who are shamed, you know, being transported in trunks of cars. So this wall creates a safe space, a place where there's a community of those who are disenfranchised and who feel they're voiceless and feel that now they have an opportunity to speak. There was a brick at the Florida Holocaust Museum where a girl wrote, "I was raped and I didn't talk about it, but I want to talk about it now." And she signed her name, actually. You know, so I think it empowers other people. And what I say that we need to acknowledge that a wall exists. We need to speak of the problems in order to be able to surmount them. So that wall, I believe, serves that purpose.
The exhibition, The Wall Speaks, Voices of the Unheard, will be running at Bank Sui, the community space right on Joseph Campo in the heart of Hamtramck. It'll run until Memorial Day, May 29th, and you can get all the details on all the events surrounding the exhibition by going to banksui.com. And we've been talking with Wojtek Sava, who created this exhibition, The Wall Speaks, Voices of the Unheard, and Alyssa Shelton of Bank Sui. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up on The Next Idea, inspiring young people to engage in science and art.
There's tremendous ability in Detroit, particularly in that 15 to 25-year-old demographic, waiting to have an opportunity to explore and to innovate and to make things.
That is in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The U.S. Marine Corps is taking legal action against a former drill instructor in the death of a recruit from Taylor. Raheel Siddiqui died after falling three stories in a stairwell in his barracks at Parris Island. That happened in March 2016. A local coroner called it suicide, but the recruit's family has vehemently rejected that. And now Gunnery Sergeant Joseph Felix will face a general court-martial on several charges related to Siddiqui's death. U.S. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell has been pressing the Marines to thoroughly investigate her constituent's death, and she is here with us now. Congresswoman, your reaction to this latest development that the Marines are going to court-martial Raheel Siddiqui's drill instructor?
I think it's very important that everybody that was involved with this be held accountable for what happened. But it has been very clear to me, I've visited Parris Island, I've talked to many people, that whatever happened that day, and none of us are ever really going to know what happened that day, that I do not believe that Private Siddiqui committed suicide and or had the intention to take his own life. So one small piece of what I am going to try to do is to work with the family and the Marines and others to have that original coroner's report changed.
So that is really an issue, the fact that that original coroner's report still stands as saying suicide.
Well, you know, it was not done by the Marines. It was done based on information that had been given a very isolated picture that day with the medical examiner. There have now been a significant number of investigations. Some of the investigations are still going on, but it is very clear that based on the facts that have been revealed in this investigation, that it wasn't Private Siddiqui's intentions to take his own life, whatever happened that day. And it's a very small piece, but this is a mother whose son is in a religion where suicide is just the worst thing that could ever happen. And if I can just bring this family some peace, even on that, it's very important for me to continue to get to the truth, make sure it never happens again, and bring this family some peace.
Congresswoman, we know that this same drill sergeant, Gunnery Sergeant Joseph Felix, had been investigated for allegedly abusing another Muslim recruit, ordering him to get in a dryer, turning it on, burning the recruit, and a second drill instructor was hit with general court-martial charges in that case yesterday. So do you think that all of this has brought about changes in the Marine Corps?
So I have a lot of things to say because I'm obviously very concerned about this. And yesterday on the Hill, at the same time that I was meeting with the Marines, my colleagues were having a hearing about what's happened in terms of the women in the Marines. We need to have strong Marines. We need to have a strong armed services. But we also need to know that when someone's going into the service, that they are being treated fairly. They've got to be tough, but not have the kinds of things that we have witnessed in the last year occur, and not be afraid to ask questions so we make sure that everybody is treated correctly. I've been talking to some of my Republican colleagues, quite frankly, one who's been enormously helpful in guiding me and supporting me, visited Paris Island with me. And he is committed with me to studying all of the branches of service to make sure that this kind of behavior is not happening and that any young person and the parents of family of that young person know that their child is going to be treated with respect and right as they are prepared to fight in the armed services.
So this is something uniting both sides of the aisle.
Daryl Issa has been incredible in supporting me and helping me. I'm not going to claim to be an expert in the military in any way, shape, and form other than thanking the men and women who serve and knowing that we need to have a strong military. But he is also very concerned about what he has seen toward Paris Island with me. And I'm going out to California to visit the camp that he has in his district as well.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Shiraz Khan is the attorney and the spokesman for the Siddiqui family, and he is with us now. Mr. Khan, what's the family's reaction to the court-martial charges against Gunnery Sergeant Felix?
I can tell you this. The family is shocked and outraged at the same time. I think what's most shocking to all of us is that the USMC command and investigation itself listed violations by multiple individuals on multiple levels of command. And so why now are the charges being centered around one person? Where are the charges against those other folks involved? Why are we not seeing that now?
And I know you've been following this and in contact with the Marines. We know that there were four commanders who were removed from their posts at Paris Island.
Correct.
What kind of charges are you hoping to see against them?
I think one of the biggest issues here is that the physical evidence in this case tells a story of torture, abuse, and suffering. And none of the charges at this time seem to align with the evidence that's already in play. I think one of the biggest issues here is that the charge of assault is missing. And you know, there's no explanation as to why the charges that should have been brought haven't been brought yet.
And no consideration of manslaughter or murder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if we look at the physical evidence in this case, you will see that the charges, as they have been brought, do not appear to be sufficient.
Nothing is going to bring their son back to them. What could help bring some to these parents some sense of justice?
I can tell you that our office is going to challenge the manner of death. We don't feel that the evidence that's already in play and that we've been given and that we have supports the finding that suicide was the most conclusive manner of death in this case. So that is something that we are definitely going to challenge. And at the same time, I can also tell you that we're going to take all the necessary steps to ensure that the family gets the answers they are looking for. And I think one of the most vital things here is to find out why, if you've released an investigative report stating that these many people were involved in the death of this person, where are those charges? And we need the answer to that. Where are those charges?
What would you say to Muslim parents or to really any parents whose children were considering joining the U.S. Marine Corps?
Well, I mean, I would say for one, this is not a Muslim issue. This is a American issue. And I think it's important to understand that Raheel died on American soil in boot camp. This wasn't on the battlefield. This was at home. And that's what's most concerning here. We need to know that our recruits are treated fairly. And at this point, the family doesn't feel that that was the case. So, I mean, for us, the family is still left with questions and deserves to get those questions answered.
Shiraz Khan is the attorney and the spokesman for the family of Raheel Siddiqui. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Mr. Khan.
You are welcome.
You're listening to Stateside, and if you miss any part of today's show, you can easily find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast, and you'll get the link.
creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
From Dublin, Ireland to Detroit, Michigan, that's the pathway of Science Gallery, described as a place where science and art collide. And the result? Creative ways to tackle some of the world's biggest problems. The first Science Gallery is in Dublin, and now Michigan State University is launching Science Gallery Lab Detroit, the first one in North America. Jeff Graybill is with us. He's Associate Provost of Teaching and Learning at Michigan State, where he directs MSU's Hub for Innovation in Learning and Technology. Jeff, what is Science Gallery exactly?
The Wellcome Trust in the UK, which is arguably the most important foundation in the UK, focused on science and public engagement, calls Science Gallery the most important public engagement project in the world. And what they mean by that is Science Gallery is best in the world at engaging 15 to 25-year-old adults in solving the world's greatest problems. And their path for doing that is creating a remarkably new learning platform in which, as you noted, science and art and human beings collide. So it's really an institution designed to engineer and facilitate collisions between people and ideas. And they do that by creating a learning experience which is not a science museum and not an art gallery, but has correspondences with both, but much more like a theater. So it's a deeply experiential moment in which people have conversations with each other and with mediators who help facilitate conversation around the ideas and the art and the science that they're seeing in the exhibit in front of them.
First of all, where is this going to be, Science Gallery Lab Detroit?
Michigan State University just became part of Science Gallery International, and Science Gallery Labs Detroit is their labs model. And the labs model is really focused on public engagement and learning prior to worrying about a building. And so it's a pop-up model. And so one of the conversations we're having with people in Detroit is about where we pop up Science Gallery. And I suspect we'll pop it up in a different location every time we do programming. But we're going to be actively looking for spaces which are interesting and compelling, which are appropriate for the Science Gallery experience that we want, so that we can move Science Gallery around the city of Detroit to engage as many people as possible, particularly young adults in that 15 to 25-year-old demographic.
So give me an idea, Jeff Graybill, as I walk into Detroit Science Gallery Lab as its pop-up location. What is it that will happen there? What will I experience?
You'll instantly be greeted. You'll be invited to experience an exhibit or an object or to read something, to engage something. You might be asked a question. You might be invited to ask a question of somebody else. That space will be energizing. It may be a little bit loud. There'll be lots of people moving around and having conversations with each other. And the objects that are on display, the art and science that's configured for people to engage with, is exciting. It's brand new. All of the objects are created specifically for those exhibits. The artists and the scientists might be there to engage with you as well. And it's kind of like a performative moving theater exhibit. So you're moving around, you're engaging in conversation. I was completely taken by the energy and the excitement in the room. It was a little bit exhausting after an hour or so, but I also felt energized and quite enthused by the human beings that I met and the ideas that I was asked to consider.
What's the end game? Is it to attract young people into, let's say, scientific or technological fields, or what is it?
Yeah, that's absolutely one of the end games. Science Gallery is a learning platform. And so one of the things that's exciting about Science Gallery for Michigan State University is we understand ourselves as a learning platform, too. And so what we're engaged in is creating a new kind of learning platform in Detroit, and we will pop it in East Lansing, and we may move it around the state, that is designed to not just engage people in science and art, but help them learn something about science and art. So that's fundamental to what Science Gallery is as a learning platform. But you're absolutely right. We're interested in helping particularly humans in that 15 to 25-year-old demographic get excited about the possibilities of science and art in terms of career, in terms of school, helping them find what they're passionate about and how they want to spend the next few years of their lives. And so it's an opportunity to get people excited, not just about Michigan State University, but about higher education, whether that's Wayne or the University of Michigan. We don't really care. We just want young people to be excited about learning and to find careers. Science Gallery Dublin has also been able to build some programming around their exhibits that focus on entrepreneurship and innovation and creativity. And we're very much interested in adding those components to the learning platform in Detroit as well.
And what do MSU researchers get from being involved with Science Gallery Lab Detroit?
There's the opportunity for researchers at Michigan State in particular, but other universities, to share their research, to communicate with the public about their research. But there are also opportunities for researchers to do research because of the engagement and the interactions at Gallery.
Jeff, will people who are not ages 15 to 25 be able to visit as these pop-up Science Gallery Lab Detroits move around?
Absolutely. So while 15 to 25 is the target, because it's a magical demographic, science museums really tend to focus on families and young people. Mm-hmm. At least those are the people who tend to come. So we're focused on 15 to 25 because that's our mission. But in Dublin, at least 30 to 40% of people who go to Science Gallery Dublin fit that demographic. The other 60 to 70% are families, adults, young children. And so while the programming is pitched towards that target demographic, most of the people who come actually fall outside. So it's a very friendly and engaging place for learners of all ages.
And where are you as far as launching Science Gallery Lab Detroit?
Well, we're moving at lightning speed for a university, so we expect to, I'm going to give you a very imprecise answer. We expect to make Science Gallery Detroit programming quite visible to people in Detroit within the next year. So we're hoping that we have something pretty special for people no later than next spring.
And how do you hope this will boost innovation throughout the state of Michigan?
Well, you know, when I look at Michigan and when I look at Detroit in particular, I see nothing but talent and possibility. And so one of our operating principles here is there's tremendous ability in Detroit, particularly in that 15 to 25-year-old demographic, waiting to have an opportunity to explore and to innovate and to make things. And so as much as anything else, Science Gallery Detroit is an invitation to engage the world, to solve hard problems. And we're quite confident, particularly based on what we've seen in Dublin, that the outcomes of that are going to be explicitly and quite concretely innovative. We're going to see young people make art, which is special. We're going to see young people come up with ideas which turn into businesses. We're going to see and expect to see a large number of young people choose to engage in careers in emerging science and in compelling art, which will have very specific, direct, and measurable outcomes for the people of the state of Michigan. But it should be said that Science Gallery, while Science Gallery is emerging right now as a compelling new idea, we're building it for the long haul. The need to create and to innovate in Detroit, in the state of Michigan, is not going to go away anytime soon. And so we're building Science Gallery Detroit as a compelling part of the infrastructure that helps Detroit imagine and create a new future.
Science Gallery Detroit, engaging Detroit's young adults and really Michigan's young adults in science and art. We've been talking with Jeff Grabel, who is the director of MSU's Hub for Innovation in Learning and Technology. Thank you so much, Jeff, for being a part of The Next Idea.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Cass Adair. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.